HHS. Mr. Pepper, whenever you're ready.
Yes. Good morning. May it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether the Court of Federal Claims erred in finding the special master abused her discretion in awarding attorney's fees and costs to petitioner's counsel. The respondent has asked this Court to interpret the Vaccine Act to require a petitioner to provide some objective evidence of vaccine causation to establish a reasonable basis for the claim alleged in the petition. This would be a significant departure from the way the Vaccine Act is currently and has historically been applied. Since the inception of the vaccine...
Let's ask you, so the statutory language at issue here appears, it states two threshold requirements before the discretion kicks in, a good faith requirement and a reasonable basis requirement. And the good faith requirement is about an act, namely the act of bringing the petition. And the reasonable basis requirement is not about an act, but about the claim asserted by the act of petitioning. Why doesn't that mean, as I think the government suggests, kind of by a straightforward reading of the language, that even if the act of petitioning was made in good faith to avoid running out of time, that that doesn't mean that the claim asserted has a reasonable basis, and that requires whatever some evidence means, however high that is, there actually has to be some evidence for the claim, even if the attorney in the act of filing was proceeding in good faith.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the reasonable basis provision does apply to the claim, and I believe the language that's used in the statute is broad enough to encompass the entire claim, including the factual basis, medical support, jurisdictional issues, and the circumstances under which the petition is filed. So I believe the language, I think the decisions that have interpreted that language, reasonable basis, in the fees provision, have looked at three things primarily. The broad nature of the language, reasonable basis.
Right, but what I'm focusing on is reasonable basis of the claim. Isn't that the language? Yes, for the claim for which the petition was brought, and as opposed to the decision to file being reasonable, which it maybe was if the lawyer was in a position of saying, I either defeat the case by running out of time, or I file now and hope that when I do the investigation, it turns out to be a claim with merit.
And it applies to the claim, and I believe the language, it doesn't require objective evidence of the claim. It requires that the claim have a reasonable basis. So if you look at the word basis, I believe that means it's broader than just tangible evidence. It implies the support or foundation for a claim, and that basis has to be reasonable. So if you look at the term reasonable, I think reasonable is context dependent, and it's a term that can't be rigidly defined. So a claim that may be reasonable under some circumstances may not be reasonable in others, and vice versa. So I think the language is broad enough to look at the entire claim, and that includes all the factors that have been applied in the totality of the circumstances test. And I also believe that the decisions that have interpreted reasonable basis have looked at those three primary things in determining that the totality of the circumstances test is the appropriate application of the reasonable basis provision of the fees of 15E. They looked at the broad language of reasonable basis. They've looked at the discretion afforded the special master in awarding fees or denying fees in unsuccessful cases. And they've looked broadly at the congressional intent in enacting the fees provision. and the congressional intent in enacting that these provision was primarily to ensure that vaccine-injured individuals have access to competent counsel. And the discretion of the special masters was viewed as important, and they believe that in order to enact that intent, special masters needed to have the discretion to award fees in non-prevailing good faith claims. So I believe that those three factors have led to the case law that the reasonable basis provision is met by the totality of the circumstances test rather than just a rigid evidentiary standard as proposed by the respondent. And I believe a rigid evidentiary standard impinges on the discretion of the special masters, which would not do anything to further congressional intent.
But what about a non-rigid evidentiary standard? I'm not quite sure what some evidence is, but this seems to be a case in which whatever that standard could mean, this case doesn't satisfy it, and that if this is to survive, if the threshold to the exercise of discretion is to be met, you need to be able to establish that filing to avoid being too late is itself enough.
I believe that the language itself supports more than just evidence. But I also believe that...
Just focus on the evidence in support of the merits of this claim. Is there any?
In this case, I believe there was some evidence.
And this is, I guess, what I'm remembering. Just tell me if I'm wrong. This is the counsel. I don't know if that was you or whoever said, I don't actually have any medical evidence, but vaccines often cause, was it Guillain-Barré syndrome or something?
Well, I believe in this case there was some evidence filed, and that some evidence was the vaccine record as well as the representations of the petitioner to counsel. And those representations, the petitioner contacted counsel and described that he was diagnosed by a neurologist with GBS within weeks of receiving a flu vaccine, and he provided a receipt of that flu vaccine, confirming that it did indeed take place.
He confirmed the vaccine took place, but there's no evidence other than his assertion that there was any injury that resulted from the vaccine.
There were no medical records showing GBS, but there were his assertions to counsel, and I believe those representations of counsel to the court represented some evidence along with a vaccine record. And I believe also counsel's knowledge of case law and experience also is a factor that provides some evidence. GBS following flu vaccine is one of the most recognized injuries in the vaccine program, and the temporal association described by the petitioner to counsel was an appropriate temporal association. So taking those facts as some evidence, and then the circumstances under which the petition was filed within he contacted counsel within days of the statute of limitations, provided the reasonable basis for that claim.
You're saying that his assertion is the evidence. So his assertion is the evidence you're relying on for a reasonable basis.
Correct. The vaccine record and his assertion.
Is there any indication of why they didn't did that? Whether the attorneys asked him, well, can you provide us any records? Are there any records to show this? Any of that in the record?
Yes, and he did not initially provide any records. Counsel attempted to contact him on several occasions to be able to collect records from him to further validate his assertions, but he essentially became absent for a period of 2 years. Then 9 days prior to the statute of limitations, he again contacted counsel, which implied that he still believed an attorney-client relationship existed. At that point, so close to the statute of limitations deadline, the special master correctly held, I believe, that the circumstances under which this petition was filed help support under the totality of the circumstances.
I guess I'm not clear. When he came to you the second time, you had him there, you were discussing it with him. Did you any indication whether you asked him then, do you have any medical records to support your contentions?
He did not have any medical records at that time.
Okay, so do you assume a hypothetical case where the statute of limitations was set to expire 3 months from the time he came to you last as opposed to 3 days? That would be entirely different, right, in your view? I mean, you're relying there's a lot of weight being put on the fact that when the last time you saw him, and he seems to be kind of an elusive fellow, but the last time you saw him, you had to do something because the statute of limitations was going to expire. Well, what if there were 3 months left the last time you saw him and you asked him, we got to get some evidence, and he never proceeded with it? So in that circumstance, would you have a reasonable basis to then wait till the third month, the eve of the statute of limitations expiration, and say, okay, reasonable basis to file because we haven't heard anything back from him, right? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that under the circumstances, those circumstances would be different. I think ultimately it would be the discretion of the special master to determine if under those circumstances the basis for that claim was reasonable. I can't say for certain that the circumstances, they would be reasonable. I would think the due diligence of counsel in trying to acquire those records, assuming he had 3 months to do so, there's obviously more time to collect records within 3 months than 9 days, and I think the due diligence of counsel is another factor. The conduct of petitioner's attorneys is also a factor that has been used in the totality of the circumstances test, and I think the special master would have the discretion to look at whether due diligence was actually undertaken by counsel, and I think it would be a different could be a different outcome in those circumstances. So the petitioner would articulate the reasonable basis standard as whether a reasonable attorney under the particular circumstances at the time would find there was sufficient support or a foundation to file or maintain a petitioner's claim. And I believe that that interpretation is supported not only by the plain language of the Vaccine Act and decades of case law, but also by legislative history, as Congress has explicitly intended.
Can you read that again to me? You said whether there's sufficient basis, whether the attorney has a sufficient, believes he has a sufficient basis?
Right. I would articulate reasonable basis standard as whether a reasonable attorney, under the particular circumstances at the time, would find there was sufficient support or foundation to file or maintain a petitioner's claim.
But that's different from the statute.
I believe that that interpretation...
whether there was a reasonable basis for the claim.
To file or maintain a petitioner's claim, and I believe that interpretation comports best with the plain language of the Vaccine Act. And I think it comports with it much better than a strict evidentiary standard. There's no mention in the fees provision of an objective evidence standard or requiring evidence in order to meet the threshold of reasonable basis.
You're into your rebuttal. Why don't we hear from you?
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. 1,239 petitions filed by at least 180 different attorneys in fiscal year 2017, according to our internal statistics.
Are these all are we talking only the off-table cases, not the on-table cases?
This includes all petitions that were filed in fiscal year 2017, but the vast majority of those are off-table cases, I think of less than 10% and possibly less than 5%. In fiscal year 17, we're off-table. That will change in the next fiscal year now that Guillain-Barré and Serva have been added to the table, so that the numbers will increase. But the point is that those numbers are not indicative of a program that is struggling to find claimants to file petitions or attorneys to represent them. The petitioner's argument in this case is based almost entirely on a policy argument articulated by this court that the Vaccine Act is intended to provide a readily available bar to represent petitioners in these cases. The fundamental flaw in petitioner's argument is that there is no evidence to support their argument that that goal is not already being met.
The fundamental flaw in their argument is about a topic that we are going to have to investigate the empirical statistics and what they actually mean, and therefore decide whether the policy, decide something about the policy strength of their point?
Actually, Your Honor, we would submit that the court doesn't even need to reach the policy issues.
Maybe even we couldn't.
That is correct. I am simply pointing out for the court that the policy argument that they make is actually not supported by the statistics that are available, which would actually weigh in favor of the government's policy argument that with the number of petitions being filed, the statute has built into it an incentive on behalf of the petitioners bar to investigate claims to make sure that they are supported by evidence prior to filing.
Let's go away from the policy and just go back to the language. I mean, here, clearly, abuse of discretion in terms of this. The special master, the government is not disputing, has a degree of discretion in deciding these, right? And they seem to... So we all agree on that piece of it, that there's a discretionary element in this. And so where is the daylight between you and the other side? They say discretion but to the special master, totality of circumstances. Now, totality of circumstances may or may not be different than the two-step procedure that you're at, the two-factor procedure that Judge Taranto referred to from the statute, right? So what's the difference?
The daylight, Your Honor, is exactly what I think Judge Lori was pointing out to with respect to the standard that was proposed by Mr. Pepper, is that the petitioner is proposing a standard that takes into almost sole consideration the reasonableness of the attorney's actions in filing the petition, which is not consistent with what Section 15E says. Section 15 is clear that in looking at the reasonable basis, the reasonable basis pertains to the claim and not to the attorney's actions.
Do you think what he's talking about, the reasonable basis for the attorney's actions, falls under the other category of good faith?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is what we believe the petitioner is advocating.
Now, you seem to be arguing about his view. Is it not your view that some of the special masters have not been doing this right? So it's more beyond just his view, right?
Yes, and I believe that I don't fault the petitioners for advocating for a position that the special masters themselves have essentially created through their own case law. And I think that, you know, there is a sense on the part of the special masters that this is supposed to be a generous program, that petitioners are supposed to be afforded every opportunity to prove their claim, and that the availability of a bar is an important factor in the prosecution of these claims. But I would point out that the generosity of the court and the special masters is already achieved by the fact that petitioners are permitted to file and complete petitions, whether the statute of limitations is impending or not. I mean, later supplement those petitions with medical records or other evidence in an attempt to establish not only the merits of the claim, but in the event the merits are found...
What's the minimum amount these attorneys could have provided to get them past the reasonable basis of the claim language?
And Your Honor, that is, we submit where the special master's discretion does come into play, but what we would submit is that there at least needs to be some evidence addressing the essential elements of each of the petitioners' elements under their prima facie case. So there would need to be evidence showing that the case was arguably timely, that the petitioner received a vaccine that is covered by the program.
Well, they did that, right? I mean, didn't they submit evidence that he got a vaccine as of a certain date?
They did submit evidence of vaccination, but what they did not submit was then the other critical requirement, was that the vaccination caused or significantly aggravated an injury. There was no evidence submitted in this case that petitioner suffered any injury at all, much less one that...
Well, is that what's missing? I mean, you're not expecting them to prove causation in their preliminary filing. So I'm just trying to hone in on how little they could have said to, in your view, satisfy the reasonable basis test.
I think in order to provide some meaningful standard that would both give the litigants some ability to determine when a reasonable basis objection is appropriate and what...
We're dealing with specific cases. It's not hard to draw out. What was it? They say they had a declaration or something by their client saying, and I'm got a disease or an illness based on this vaccine. Is that kind of submission of that affidavit enough? You're saying no, right?
Well, I think it's under the abuse of discretion standard. You know, what the court generally looks at is there a rational basis for what the special master found? And so I think there would have to be some evidence that would provide some rational basis that the special master could say that there is evidence to meet the essential elements of the claim.
So why is not, was it a declaration? I don't remember what it was. I mean, they had something from their client saying, I've I'm suffering an injury.
Actually, Your Honor, there was not even an affidavit from the petitioner. The only...
So if you get an if you submit an affidavit by a client saying, I am suffering injury X, because which I believe is caused by the vaccine, is that enough? Is that a reasonable basis to file?
I think the special master, I think that would be a closer case than what we have here, but I don't necessarily think that a special master would have good grounds upon that evidence alone to find a reasonable basis, since the statute requires that a petitioner provide substantiating documentation and specifically says that a special master cannot find based on the claims of the petitioner alone.
You would say that we're not in a position here to lay out what would be required, because the only fact before us is the fact of vaccination.
Yes, Your Honor. We are not asking you today to articulate specifically what quantum of evidence is required to meet the reasonable basis standard, but what we are asking you to do is to say that some evidence is required to meet the reasonable basis standard, that this notion that you can look...
An injury and a connection.
Some injury of the injury, the connection with the vaccination, and then the other essential elements, including the timeliness aspect of the claim, the other jurisdictional issues, such as that it was administered in the United States. As long as there's evidence submitted to meet those critical elements that are set out in Section 11C of the Act, then we would submit that a special master can, at that point, exercise his or her discretion in determining whether that evidence is sufficient to meet the reasonable basis requirement. But absent that evidence, we submit that the special master is not authorized to go beyond the evidence and look at the conduct of the petitioner's attorney in bringing the claim to determine whether it was reasonable under the circumstances, as petitioners have asked this court to find, to file the petition, because that simply isn't consistent with the plain language of Section 15.
Are there sources of law that use the expression reasonable basis and provide some clarifying guidance as to what that might mean in practice?
Unfortunately, no, Your Honor. And this goes to the point that the Vaccine Act is unique in the sense that it actually provides for...
But the phrase reasonable basis, that's not somewhere else in the law?
I'm not aware of the term reasonable basis being used in any context to define what constitutes a statutory basis for fee shifting. Again, as I was saying, the Vaccine Act is unique in that it allows for awards of attorney's fees to even unsuccessful claimants. And so in other fee shifting statutes, you have the substantially prevailing language that usually governs whether an award of fees is available. That's why this language in the Act, we think, is somewhat unique.
So in our discussion, it's become clear that, reasonable basis could be a little flexible. Then you've also repeated several times that there's a lot of discretion left to the special master. So I'm just wondering, are you advocating just a firm rule? You can never consider, in the context of reasonable basis, the time frame upon which the attorney was operating. In other words, said another way, why is it wrong under an abuse of discretion standard, looking at just the reasonable basis stuff, to factor in something may have been reasonable because you only knew about, you only had 2 days to file versus reasonable because you had 3 months to file? Can't that be a factor?
I think our answer is no, that it really should not be, that the statute of limitations issue is in some ways a red herring. Because if you think about it, the risk of being able to prove or not prove a reasonable basis for the claim for the purpose of awarding attorney's fees is really not taken on at the moment that the petition is filed, is actually taken on at the moment that the representation is accepted. So it's at the moment that the petitioner's attorney agrees to take on the petitioner that the attorney is then placed with the risk of potentially not being able to, at some later point, prove a reasonable basis for the claim. Because in both circumstances, the attorney is having to rely generally on the representations of the potential client and determining whether, based on their professional judgment, it makes sense to accept the representation. So I don't see how you can really distinguish the situation where there is a statute of limitations that requires a filing of a petition that may later bear out to have a reasonable basis or not, and a attorney who sets a representation and has time to conduct an investigation of the claim and either will or will not file a petition based on whether they perceive that there's a reasonable basis. There's no distinction between the two without treating one group unfairly, which would be the group that gets the client in time to actually conduct an investigation. This is why we believe that an evidence-based standard is the most fair. It treats counsel fairly regardless of when they agree to accept the representation, whether it's 2 days before the statute runs, whether it's 2 months before the statute runs, whether, as in this case, it was really 2 years before the statute ran, the counsel had an opportunity to investigate the claim, notwithstanding the petitioner's noncompliance and noncooperation.
And can you just get back and clarify on this question of, I think you said that there was no affidavit or other declaration from Mr. Simmons, but was there some kind of assertion he made telephonically or otherwise to counsel? This is a kind of what does the record say question.
Right. My understanding is that there were, and what the special master includes in her decision is that there were two contacts and two conversations, and one of which she found dispositive, but that she does note during the final conversation with the petitioner, and this is at Appendix 6 on star page 2, that counsel spoke with petitioner again on the telephone with regard to the collection of medical records. That is the sum total of what I'm aware of in terms of counsel's conversations with petitioners about what evidence may or may not be available.
So there isn't nothing in the record says Mr. Simmons said
there.
I had a vaccine. I am ailing in some way. Even that.
I would have to go back and look at the actual fee application. I believe it was in the fee application that counsel detailed the conversations and the contacts with Mr. Simmons, but I don't believe that level of detail was provided as to why he did not provide the information, other than I believe the record reflects that it was distressing to him to relive the whole experience of his alleged GBS, and that was why he had been out of communication with his counsel. I did just want to briefly address CLOR in the time that I have remaining. It was raised in the gray brief for the first time, and I would simply note that I think that the petitioner has taken that CLOR a little bit too far. If you look at the language that's cited in CLOR, and this is on page 1362 at 675 F3rd, petitioner relies on language saying the statutory language requiring a reasonable basis is broad enough to encompass the statute of limitations. But our reading of CLOR is actually, and if you go on to read that same paragraph, that there is a separate determination that the court acknowledged would have to be conducted once the timeliness issue was resolved, and that is that fees would only be awarded upon a finding of good faith and reasonable basis. So our reading of the CLOR decision, en banc decision, is that these really are two distinct determinations. The statute of limitations or timeliness issue is distinct from the reasonable basis issue, and even under the majority's decision in CLOR, both of those determinations require a look at the evidence that is offered to support the actual merits of the arguments and on the underlying claims. And with that, thank you.
You've got a few minutes left. Do you want to address Judge Toronto's question first about really what the evidence was beyond that he had got a vaccine on a certain date?
Sure. So Mr. Simmons, the evidence consisted of the vaccine record that was provided by Mr. Simmons, and it also consists of assertions Mr. Simmons made to counsel in a phone conference.
Those assertions had what content? What did he say?
He said that he suffered. He was seen by a neurologist and diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome within 3 weeks of receiving his flu vaccine that he received on October 26, 2010. There was never any tangible medical record that we had in our hand, but we did provide that information to the special master. In Choizano,
I'm still not clear. So you had a phone conversation with your client in which he made this representation. Then what did you actually put into the record?
We detailed the conversation. So we did bring to the special master's attention, I believe it was in the context of the fee application, that Mr. Simmons received a vaccine as confirmed by the vaccine receipt. He went to a neurologist and was diagnosed with GBS by the neurologist within 3 weeks of receiving the flu vaccine. So that was our summit.
What did you allege in the complaint? When you filed the petition or the complaint or whatever it is, what was alleged there?
We alleged in the complaint a neurological demyelinating injury, just to keep it broad in case, you know, the medical record showed perhaps, you know, something else. And GBS is a neurological demyelinating injury. But rather than saying specifically GBS, we kept it vague for the purposes of that petition.
So you said in the complaint he has suffered as a result of the vaccine blood?
Correct. Correct. We have said he has suffered a neurological demyelinating injury as a result of the flu vaccine he received on October 26, 2010.
And then for purposes of fees, you established the basis for that being this conversation you had with him.
That's correct. That's correct. And I just want to reiterate in the time that I have left that the totality of the circumstances test has been a universally adopted interpretation of the reasonable basis provision since the inception of the vaccine program. And in Senior Judge Firestone's decision, she did acknowledge that the totality of the circumstances test was the correct analysis, but she didn't articulate how the special master abused her discretion in awarding fees and costs in this case. You asked about whether there's another rule of law that uses a reasonable basis language. And in the briefs, I discussed Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 11, which I don't believe uses reasonable basis language specifically, but it is an objective standard of reasonableness under the circumstances.
It uses language about whether a factual assertion is reasonably based in belief or lack of information. I think that's some phrase like that.
Correct. And compliance with Rule 11 is measured by an objective standard of reasonableness under the circumstances, and an impending statute of limitations deadline is an important factor in applying Rule 11, and also the discretion of the district court in applying Rule 11 is viewed as paramount. So I think the standard of, that the respondent asks you to adopt would place counsel who practice in the vaccine program differently than counsel who practice in federal district court with regard to whether a claim is reasonable at the time it was filed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding for this morning.